We'll now turn this over to our brother Glendon Rhodes on his topic, Godly Relationships, Part 1.
Thank you, Brother Pat. Really a privilege for us to all be able to get together like this weekends throughout the year. So, godly relationships. There's a lot of different relationships that the term godly should apply to in our lives, but these two classes will specifically be looking at romantic relationships, dating, pre-marriage, and even a lot of the things that apply to marriage. But specifically, this is for some of us younger ones who aren't married yet and have a lot of questions about what advice does the Bible give us, what commands does the Bible give us about how to relate to the opposite sex. I find this a really challenging topic. It's intimidating because I've been trying to get it sorted out for over a decade now, and instead of having list of successes, I have a list of failures, plenty of things I've done wrong. Usually when somebody gets up to speak on a topic, they have a list of qualifications. Instead, I have a list of failures, a lot of mistakes that I've made. Besides all my own mistakes, though, it's a tough subject anyway. A lot of times the folks that are married don't have very much advice because they didn't date for very long. And those of us who have been on the dating scene for a long time must have something wrong or we wouldn't still be there, right? So the general first consensus seems to be that the Bible doesn't shed a whole lot of light on dating. It tells us about marriage, but it doesn't tell us a lot about dating. The biblical advice that we pass around kind of stops short at, don't have sex until you're married. Make sure you marry someone in the truth. And those are both certainly very true. But it's such a short guide. We're talking about the foundation of the most important human relationship we experience. A relationship that was established by God at the very creation of mankind. Surely He had something in mind, some ground rules for developing that relationship besides just keep it in your pants till the honeymoon. Surely, right? Actually, there are several references in scriptures to the way we should treat the opposite gender. I think one of the problems is that we find it way too easy to put romantic relationships in one bin over here and all of our other relationships in another bin over here, and say that there's different rules that apply to each one. Our society has taught us that romance plays by different rules than the rest of our lives. Think about some of the phrases you hear about love. All is fair in love and war. The phrase gives us the idea that dating is above all of the rules that we live the rest of our lives by. Phrases like that teach us that we should neglect the principles we live the rest of our lives by when we look for romantic love. They compare love to a game of musical chairs in which you either look out for yourself at the expense of others or you lose out. Do you think that's what God wanted? Expressions like the dating game or the game of love suggest that looking for that help meet is either a competition in which your friends and your opponents are hard to distinguish, and action and chance dictate winners and losers. Or worse, it suggests that the purpose of romantic relationships is ultimately entertainment value. The stories of he likes her, but she likes him diminish the search for a spouse to a game of connect the dots or match them up. But surely this is not the type of heartless, unprincipled gambling that God had in mind to bring about the marriage relationship. God uses the marriage relationship as a picture of Christ's relationship with the saints. He looks at marriage as the highest and deepest form of love that we experience in our natural lives. And He compares it to the spiritual relationship that our whole life should be centered on. Surely the relationship that He honors so highly is not born out of selfish inconsideration. Surely there is something much higher than the world we live in realizes. So where do we find God's principles? How exactly does He want us to develop a relationship before marriage? That's the question we are here to explore. I'll go ahead and tell you now, if you're looking for all the verses in the Bible that mention dating or courting, you're going to be disappointed because they're just not there. But if you open your Bible and look for the word love, you better roll up your sleeves because it's everywhere you look in the Bible. So doing this class over off a set of modules, you might notice I pick up a new one every now and then. Some of them you'll notice, some you won't. But there's several different topics that we'll explore. They're all around this basic theme of love and dating. So the Bible talks a lot about love. But I think most of us know love can have a whole string of different meanings. She loves shopping. He loves orange soda. They're in love. They love their family. She loves her brothers and sisters in Christ. So when we're looking through our Bible at the word love, what type of love is it that applies to dating and marriage relationships? Does every scriptural reference to love apply to romance? Or is this a completely different type of love with which the Bible doesn't deal? There are two verses in particular that give us the answer very quickly. One is in Ephesians 5, verse 25. It simply says, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the Ecclesia and gave himself for it." The next is Colossians 3, 19, which also says, "Husbands, love your wives, and be not bitter against them." So, very clearly in these two verses, we're talking about the love between a man and a woman in a marital relationship. That's what we're specifically referring to, right? So we know it's the kind of love that we want to talk about in these classes. The original word here is agapo. It's just the verb from the word agape, which some of you may have heard. Agape is the typical word for love in the New Testament. It's commonly found throughout the New Testament. We usually find it translated in the King James Version either love or charity. And there are several other words for love in the New Testament. We won't take time today to look at each of them, but this we can know. Whenever we see this word agape, we can rest assured that it does apply to the type of love that should exist between a woman and a man in marriage. And if we take a step back, dating is a development of that love. We'll quickly find that it is the same word that describes the love that should exist between brothers and sisters, between God and man, and between fellow men. Look at this. Matthew 5, verse 43 and 44. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor.'" That's agape. It's the same love we're talking about this morning. "You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for them that persecute you." Love your neighbor, love your enemies. That's the same word as used for a husband and wife. Matthew 6, 24, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." So loving your master uses the same word. Loving money. And in Matthew 22, "And he said to them, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And a second like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself.'" So you see, while we might like to separate our love into romantic love and other kinds of love, the Bible does not separate them in this manner. The love that applies to a courtship, to your boyfriend or girlfriend, or in a marriage, must be the same type of love that applies to our relationship with God and with our neighbors. If we can accept this basic fact, we will find that the scriptures give us a wealth of information, advice, and guidelines on our interactions with a potential spouse. Suddenly, love is not an interaction that is above the other rules of life, but it is founded on the same principles. It's not a game in which different rules apply or in which rules can change, but it is an interaction that is built on the same framework as our love of God, our love of Christ, our love of the Ecclesia, and of our neighbors. It is important to understand what that love is because it must dictate every action we make, whether it is towards a person we are attracted to or not. We read in 1 John 4, chapter 8, "He that loves not knows not God, for God is love. So we learn from this that when we look at God, we have a perfect and definitive image of love. He tells us exactly, he shows us exactly what love is. When we look at Christ, what do we see? We see a perfect manifestation of God's character, right? So we have a perfect image of love in Christ as well. And what does it look like? What does love look like in God and Christ? Here's a passage we can easily grow numb to. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Love looks like sacrifice for others. It's a giving of oneself for the benefit of others. We read further in Romans 5:8. But God commends his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. This teaches us that love is about providing for the need of someone else, truly helping someone else out, even when that person doesn't deserve it, even when it does not serve our own wants. Christ died for us long before we even acknowledged him. He did it without us asking. He did it because it was what we needed, even though it wasn't what we deserved, even though it was completely against his own desires. And that's what love is. Think about this in the context of dating. Putting aside your own wants for the betterment of a person. Even though it was completely against his own desires, that's what Christ did. Love is taking the time to understand what someone really needs and then to provide it to them even at your own expense, even when that person doesn't deserve it. The flesh replies, but what about me? What about my needs? What about my wants? Isn't that what dating's about? Isn't it about me? But you see, that's the wrong approach. If we can show God's love in our relationships, if we can make his glory our priority instead of our wants, he will provide for us. And we'll be able to recognize it when he does. Love might be expressed as care. To love someone is to care about them enough to find out what they really need for their well-being now and in the future, and then to provide it for them in the best way possible. That does not always mean fulfilling present desires, especially sexual desires. It actually means avoiding the very situations that our flesh craves. Love is the characteristic that must overarch all of our actions and characteristics. Firstly, love of God, of his ways, his plan, his gracious blessings on us. And secondly, love of our neighbors, care for individuals around us, service and personal sacrifice for the true well-being of others. So our attitude must be one of care and willingness to do for others in developing love. That applies to love between brothers and sisters, love of our neighbors, and also, especially, the love between a young man and a young woman as they pursue marriage. Now, take a look at this. Romans 13. Owe no man anything but to love one another. This is Romans 13, verses 8 through 10. Owe no man anything but to love one another. For he that loves another has fulfilled the law. For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love works no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. You see this? You see what he did here? He just made all of the commands a part of loving your neighbor. It includes someone you're romantically attracted to, doesn't it? If we wish to truly love a person, we must incorporate God's commands in the way we deal with that person. Each of Christ's commands is an integral part of true love. And which command did he mention first? Anyone remember which command he just mentioned first? thou shalt not commit adultery is the first command he mentions. That's a part of love. Fleeing fornication is a part of love. Command is flee fornication. It is a part of love. We do not show love when we participate in sexual immorality. It is incompatible with love because the law of God is love. And these things are a part of that law. Of course, today the word love is often used to mean committing fornication. The word love is used to mean having sexual interaction or otherwise making out, even outside of marriage. But that is not correct, is it? God is actually telling us that love is staying as far as possible from sexual interaction before marriage. Flee fornication. That is love. So, young men, you have a girl that you are intensely affectionate for. She makes your head kind of feel light when you're around her. She's beautiful in every way. How can you show your love for her? Think about that for a minute. You got somebody you're just head over heels for. How do you show your love for them? Is it in the passionate kisses that couples often share? Is it in the flowers and candlelight and time alone that husbands and wives share? No. It isn't in any of these things. It is actually in obeying God's commands. It's as simple as that. It is in manifesting God's character in the way you deal with that young lady. That's how you show her your love. Young ladies, same for you. Sexual immorality is rampant in the world, even at a young age, at every age. We cannot allow ourselves to confuse sexual immorality with love. He that loves another fulfills the law. One of Christ's commands is in Romans 15, let each of us please his neighbor for his good to build him up. For Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. It is obvious then that we cannot approach an individual with the attitude, this is what I want. This is what I want out of the relationship. No, it says, let each of us please his neighbor for his good or benefit, to build him or her up, to encourage him or her in the right way. The highest love for another person, mark this, young people, the highest love for another person is found when your influence on that person brings them closer to God. Loving a person is making them a better servant of Christ. That's what loving someone is. But I'm telling you now, that is not easy. When we're around someone we like, we want to dress in a way that gets their heart going, pitta-patta, pitta-patta. Don't we? We want to do the things that get them excited, don't we? But we have to stop and ask ourselves one question. Does what we are doing help them serve God? Does tempting them to step closer to sexual immorality help them obey the commands of Christ? No. Now that doesn't mean you've got to wear stained sweatpants every time you see them. Guys, it doesn't mean you have to do all the things that gross them out. It just means that you have to behave towards that person with some class and respect. Sounds kind of old school, doesn't it? By the way, girls, the really good guys are actually looking for a classy lady, not a hot chick. They're looking for a classy lady, not a hot chick. And guys, as far as girls go, the really good catches, they're looking for a man that they can count on, a man that they can count on to represent Christ. They want someone that's going to be the anchor for their life. Someone who's happy and fun, but who is solid as a rock when it comes to their values. We're quite a ways in here. I think we'll go ahead and have a little story time for a minute. Sound all right? There's a story that displays the disagreement that can be caused by having two different views of love. or two different understandings of a situation around love. The lesson really applies to our relationships, especially romantic ones. Now, you've all heard the first story before. You've heard it because it's a true story. It goes like this. It's in John 18. If any of y'all want to turn it up, John 18, verses 1 to 12. So this is right before Jesus' crucifixion. It says in John 18, starting at verse 1, Jesus went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples went into. Now Judas, who would betray him, also knew of the place, for Jesus met there often with his disciples. So Judas, having gotten a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all things that would happen to him, came forward and said to him, Whom do you seek? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am he. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, Whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go. This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken. Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? So the band of soldiers and their captain and officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Notice, Jesus had already demanded that the apostles be let go. He said, If you seek me, let these men go. But Peter loved Christ. He was willing to fight to the death to protect him. Even if he were just a simple fisherman with a single sword against a band of armed soldiers and officers. These were Roman soldiers, by the way. He was willing to give his life if it would allow Jesus just the time to escape. There's no chance he was going to win. Peter was acting out of love for Christ and care and adoration for him. Christ was acting out of love as well. The scriptures tell us that Christ's love is most apparent in his submission to the death on the cross. If they were both acting out of love, how come their actions were so different? Why was their disagreement so strong? We find the difference back in verse 4. Jesus, knowing all things that should happen to him, acted on his love. Peter understood not these things and acted on his love. You see, had Peter succeeded in stopping Jesus' crucifixion, he would have taken away all hope of life for himself and for every other human in creation. That sacrifice was terribly hard for the moment, but to be salvation for a huge multitude thereafter. Jesus was acting for the long-term benefit. Peter was acting for the present benefit. Jesus was acting out of love and according to knowledge. Peter was acting out of love in ignorance. We find the same disagreement in actions of love in a romantic setting. Let's have another story. Take two couples, for instance. It's couple A and couple B. Couple A met through a mutual friend at a get-together. They instantly liked one another and found conversation easy and comfortable. In fact, they found that they had an amazing amount of similarities. Their personalities seemed so well-suited, it was just amazing. That soon led to a date, and the chemistry was so strong that they gave themselves to one another, physically, that very night, on their first date. The girl tells her friends about it the next day, saying that she loved him so much that it was the only thing she could do. Nothing had felt so right as giving herself to someone she loved. And of course, he said the same. And couple A lived happily ever after. Until a few months later, one of them found someone more exciting, and they both began a horrible downward spiral of betrayal, hatred, divorce, mistrust, skepticism towards love, and depression. A modern love story that is way too common. Now, there's lots of songs about this love story, by the way. One of them's a chart topper in today's charts. It's called Talk Dirty. And then there's another one, Do What You Want With My Body. And there's another one that's called Come and Get It. And then, of course, the rest of the story is in that song, I Drove My Car Into a Bridge, I Don't Care. And lastly, another chart topper, I Hate Love. It's the love of today's society. That is what love means to today's society. No wonder all the songs we hear on the radio are about it. No wonder confusion in relationships is at an all-time high. No wonder divorce is so common and marriage is often foregone altogether. Couples just live together in a common law marriage with only the slightest of commitment. Now take couple B. B for boring, most celebrities would say today. But let's just wait and see who gets the last laugh. Their first meeting was as kids. They'd gotten to know one another and eventually became something you might call friends over knowing one another and seeing one another occasionally. While there was nothing more in their younger years, by the time they hit their late teens, the chemistry was undeniable. However, each of the two had committed to approaching relationships in the wisdom of God's ways, which meant displaying patience and trusting in God's timing and ability to provide. As such, both had refused to develop a self-serving romance. Both had, by this time, come to an understanding of the truth and made a commitment to it. The young man begins to spend time with the young lady around her family and his. He and the young lady discuss their commitment to God and how that should frame their relationship and actions towards one another. While physical affection is certainly a craving for both of them, they are both determined to avoid sexual immorality and even to go as far as the Lord commands as to flee fornication. Those discussions weren't easy to have to start with. They weren't the most fun thing to talk about, but they knew it was best. They both knew that God's way is the best for each of them individually, and if things worked out, it would be best for their marriage. They both wanted God's blessings upon their relationship as a brother and sister and as a couple. As a matter of fact, their commitment to these things was so strong that they shared their first kiss on their wedding day. On their wedding day. It was tough dating like that. But waiting until marriage to enjoy all the little pleasures of romance has made them appreciate it so much that they enjoy it long after the fire has burned out in other relationships. Even after 10 years of marriage, they do the things that most couples stop doing after the first month of dating. Things like moving the chairs in the cafe so they're close enough to hold hands while having coffee. Things like getting lost in thought about their spouse in the middle of a conversation. Let's talk about these two couples, couple A and couple B. Now, both these couples went to a very extreme action, don't you think? Who thinks both of these are pretty extreme? Yeah, okay, I agree. I mean, fornicating with someone right after you meet them is pretty extreme. And not kissing until you're married, that's pretty extreme too, right? They were opposite extremes. But they both expressed that the motive behind their actions was love. One of them is way down there, the extreme end, and the other is way down there at the extreme end, and they both said, the reason we were there is love. They both said they did what they did out of an intense love for one another. However, the disagreement in their actions and their mentality is huge. What is that difference? Well, it's basically the same as the difference between the mentality of Peter and Christ. Couple A was acting on things without knowledge. They were acting ignorantly. They may have felt an intense affection for one another, but it did not bring them to look out for the permanent well-being of one another. Instead, it led them to fulfill the desires of the moment, without regard for future consequences. The second couple, couple B, acted out of an intense affection for one another as well. However, their love was one according to knowledge. Knowledge of what was truly best for one another, not just what was desired in the heat of the moment. It was a love that looked for the long-term goodness of the other, that wanted the very best for the other both now and in the future, even if it meant present sacrifice. It was a love that Christ can associate with. A love that sacrifices present enjoyment for future goodness. Isn't that what our life is about? Sacrificing present pleasure for future enjoyment. It is a love that sacrifices fun, we might say, for true enjoyment. It's a love that looks to the development of righteousness, peace, and true joy for one another. You might think of it this way. It's kind of like trading in a sour gummy worm from a year-old package that you could eat right now. You're trading it in so that in a couple hours you could have the most decadent strawberry cheesecake made by Europe's finest chef all for yourself. You got to wait for it. Sometimes that gummy worm looks good, though. Even if we know, we ain't going to feel very good after we eat it. There's several expressions for it, that gummy worm, sour gummy worm. They call it the hookup. Some people call it casual. Some people call it friends with benefits, one-night stand, getting lucky, scoring. The list goes on. People talk about it all the time nowadays. But they're all about one thing. And that one thing is intimacy without commitment. Okay? Intimacy without commitment. They want sexual interaction with no strings attached. Well, what's the problem with that? Most folks would ask. I've got something she wants. She's got something I want. We're just scratching each other's backs. Some would argue, if it's consensual, it's fine, so long as it's done safely. As a matter of fact, that's the mindset that's taken in education of our children as far as sexual intimacy goes. As servants of Christ, though, the question of what's the problem with that is quite easy to answer, isn't it? Because we know we're no longer in slavery to sin, but rather we live our lives according to the new man, according to the law of grace in Christ Jesus. His commands forbid even the consideration of sexual intimacy outside the commitment of marriage. He says in Ephesians 5 verse 3, "Do not let sexual sin, impurity of any kind, or greed even be mentioned among you as is proper for saints." Flee fornication, he beseeches his brothers and sisters. And his true brothers and sisters will not take that commandment lightly. While this intimation is certainly reason enough for avoiding sexual intimacy before marriage commitment, the scriptures do go on to explain to us why it's in our best interest. He says in that verse, "Flee fornication. Every sin that a man does is without the body," or outside the body. "But he that commits fornication sins against," who do you think he sins against? His own self, yeah, his own self. Isn't that odd? When you commit fornication, you're sinning against your own self. If we read that in the English Standard Version, it says, "Keep on running away from sexual immorality. Any other sin that a person commits is outside his body, but the person who sins sexually sins against his own body." What Paul is saying is that sexual immorality will hurt you. He's saying that you are hurting yourself by enjoying intimacy outside the marriage bond. It may be enticing, but run the other way, because it will only hurt you. Why, though? Why would accepting something that you desire hurt you? Well, Christ says, we'll get to this point, just follow my argument here and you'll see why. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. That is why a man will leave his father and mother and be united with his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, man must never separate. But what was the situation in which male and female were created? Why was marriage instituted in this way? Why is it a man and female for male and female for life? Well, in Genesis 2, we find this. If you want to turn up Genesis 2, it's easy to find, everyone. It's just the second chapter. Genesis 2, starting at verse 18. This is where marriage is instituted. And he's going to explain, if you listen closely, he explains why God created the woman and why he made marriage. Okay, let's think about that as we're reading here. Genesis 2, verse 18. And the Lord said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an help meet for him." And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to all the cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found an help meet for him. And the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs, and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore," in other words, because of this, "therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." So what's this a story about? It's a story about God seeing the need of man. Isn't that how it started out? The Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone." He saw that man had a need. He understood that need. Now, while we feel certain cravings, as young men or young women, we feel certain cravings, certain desires, we can't really fully understand our need for intimacy and companionship, can we? God designed and created us. He completely understands that desire. When we read the phrase, "God said, it is not good that the man should be alone," we should see in that phrase that God had consideration for and sympathy with man's need for companionship. As his creator, doesn't he understand your need for companionship too? So God sees man's need, and he has a perfect understanding of it, and he condescends to man. His response to that understanding of man's need was the provision of what? What filled the hole that man had? Was it sexual intimacy? It was marriage. Marriage filled the hole. God condescended to man and he provided for his needs in the provision of marriage. "I will make an help meet for him." An help meet, singular. God understood that the man did not need a single event of intimacy or several events of intimacy to satisfy his void. What he needed was a lifelong companion suited to him. He understood this well enough to state that no other object of his creation was suitable to fill that void. Then he created that helpmeet. He created the woman from the man with the specific purpose of creating a helpmeet for him. He designed her to fill that void. Now, what does that have to do with fornication or sexual immorality? Remember the question we asked at the beginning? How does sexual immorality hurt oneself? You see, God gave man exactly what he needed, and it was not just a sexual relationship. It was not intimacy without commitment. See, that's something we often think we crave, and the world around us has no qualms about telling you that's what they crave. But that's not our void. That doesn't fill our void. You see, God understood that what the man needed was commitment. Commitment. He needed a lifelong relationship. He did not just need some temporary enjoyment. He did not just need short-term pleasure. That is not what would fill his void. If it were, that's what God would have created to fit that need. Instead, it says, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife. That statement is a description of what fulfills the need of man. He needed someone suited to him to cleave to hold fast to never leave. That is what man needed. Man needed commitment. He needed someone to give all of himself to and someone who would give all of herself to him. Not just for a short while. When I say all of himself or all of herself, I mean the whole body, the whole heart, the whole mind, for the whole life. Giving only a part of any of those things ruins the relationship. It no longer fills the void. And the woman was created from the man. We've been talking about the man's needs, right? But the woman was created from man. She was bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. She needs the same thing. She needs commitment. She needs a lifelong relationship. What she does not need is a one-night stand. She does not need a relationship, no matter the intensity, that will end before death. This God realized. He therefore created marriage. Note this well. He created marriage in direct response to the need of the man. It is the answer to mankind's issue of being alone. Intimacy is a part of that relationship, a part of that commitment, but only a part. Temporary affection does not satisfy mankind's needs. Actually, it only makes that need worse. And here is the answer to our question when we started this section. Flee fornication. Every sin that a man does is without the body, but he that commits fornication sins against his own body. He sins against his own body because he gives it something that will hurt it rather than help it. Imagine this. Just for a second here. Imagine that a child has been starved. You have a child here. It's been starved for so long that it has physical hunger pains because its digestive system is shutting down. Okay? That's how bad this child needs food. You might think in that situation that anything would help. Anything you can put down that child's throat is better than nothing, right? Now imagine that child gorging itself on a box of rat poison. Does it satisfy the child? Perhaps for a moment. Perhaps for a short spell, the child is free of the pain of hunger. It can finally satisfy its need to shove something into its mouth. But then what? Then the poison begins to take effect. And the pain for the child is much worse than had it just continued hungry, patiently enduring until proper food was found. What is the final effect? It is that the latter end is worse than the beginning. That is why fornication is a sin against oneself. It hurts the person who indulges in it. No matter how lonely you are, no matter how starved for affection you are, you do not put rat poison down your throat. Do not try to satisfy that craving with a one-night stand. Do not try to satisfy it with anything except God's provision for it, and that is perfect commitment. It is marriage. If that's not enough to persuade you to flee from it, to flee from fornication, consider that the other person that you have so much affection for, the other person that you're involved for, is getting the same thing. They have an empty belly. They're starved for affection. But you're filling that empty belly with poison when you give them short-term pleasure. No one who truly cares for a person would do this to them, even if they asked for it. Just as no person would give a hungry child poison, even if they wanted it. This is the problem with two people hooking up. This is the problem with two people who want intimacy and want to give it to one another only for a short time. Intimacy without commitment is robbery. Both individuals rob themselves and they rob the other person. I think we'll pause for here and we'll pick up again this afternoon in the next class. But let's keep in mind those principles. Man had a need, and a woman has that same need. It's a hole that is only filled with marriage. Okay? God made marriage to perfectly fill that void. And putting something other than that in there, no matter how much we crave it, is not going to satisfy it. Remember also that we talked about the definition of love. What love really is. It's not what we find in the world's definition. It's not making out. It's not your craving for orange soda. Love in romantic scenarios, the love that you show a girl that you're attracted to or a man that you admire, has to follow the same principles that our love for the brother and sisters do, our love for God does, our love for our neighbor does. Okay? And the best way to show that love is in treating that person with God's character, with godly character. Remember we talked about Peter and Jesus in the garden, how one of them acted out of love in ignorance, one of them acted out of love according to knowledge, and we talked about those two couples, the one who acted ignorantly and the one who established a good foundation for a future relationship. Okay, so we'll pick up there this afternoon, God willing.